Hi, welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 64 for October 30th, 2006. Coming up in a few minutes.
The first thing that hits you is the aroma. I mean, all the old style warehouses have got very thick stone walls, so it's nice and cool, a little bit humid, and what hits you is that peppery alcohol aroma when you walk in. And I don't know quite just how to describe that, but I mean, if you do it, it's just one of those things that hits you.
That's Jim Cryle, now in semi-retirement after 40 years of making scotch, most recently at the Glenlivet. I sat down with Jim a couple of weeks ago at Whiskey Live in Toronto, and you'll hear the entire interview in just a few minutes. First, though, let's look at the news. If you've been wondering, and believe me, I've heard the questions, about just when Brooklotte's new Port Charlotte single malt will be available, it should be fairly soon now. Turns out the first bottles of PC5 Evolution, as the first edition of the five-year-old malt is being called, rolled off the bottling line at Brooklotte this past week. They should be heading to retailers as you're listening to this. And here's hoping the boys at Brooklotte decide to bring some to next week's Whiskey Fest in New York. Speaking of Whiskey Fest, tickets are already sold out. Malt Advocate Magazine's annual event will be held at the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square. And while there are usually a handful of book signings at Whiskey Fest, John Hansel tells us there will be even more authors on hand this year.
Yeah, we've got David Wishart coming in, and Jim Murray's supposed to be coming over. Not sure about Michael Jackson yet, but, and we have, Martine DeWitt is going to be coming over. We've got, and others too. It's going to be a good from a, you know, from an author perspective too, to be able to actually not just meet with the people who are making the whiskeys, but also some of the really cutting edge, authors and writers, whiskey writers who are doing a lot in the industry will be there too. So I'm looking forward to it.
Again, the event is a sellout, but if you're in the New York area, there are a number of Whiskey Fest related events scheduled for next week. Just a couple here. Highland Park will host a tasting dinner with Whiskey Classified author Dr. David Wishart on Sunday night at St. Andrew's Restaurant. That same night, the Park East Grill will host a Gordon McPhail tasting and dinner with Michael Urquhart. You'll find more events on the calendar at the WhiskeyCast website. By the way, my wish list for Whiskey Fest includes Gordon and McPhail's Ben Romack Organic. It was released earlier this year and is billed as the first whiskey to be certified as organically produced in the UK. Here's Gordon and McPhail's Ewan McIntosh.
An incredible whiskey which we were able to produce in 2000 and had to go through the strict sort of regulations to do with the production of organic foodstuff. Which involved using organic malted barley, organic yeast, and most unusually, the use of organic casks. We were unable to source organic sherry or bourbon casks, so we had to use virgin oak casks from a sustainably managed forest in Missouri, which then, after 6 years maturation, yielded a very rich, flavoursome malt whiskey, picking up quite a lot of new oak characteristics from the new casks, but allowed us to get this fully certified organic Bernomic whiskey, which we were able to launch this year.
I have to ask, which standards were harder to meet, the organic standards or the SWA standards?
They are both very easy. I think the organic is very much down to the process and the distillery, so there are certain aspects we have to adhere to at the distillery to avoid cross-contamination between non-organic product and organic material. And it's that similar case in the bottling hall as well. But the SWA were very supportive. The use of virgin oak casks has been used in the past, so there is records of that happening. So there was no issues at all from the SWA.
The wish list also includes the latest from Compass Box, John Glazer's Oak Cross Malt, which has just been released. It comes right after his Ontario-only vatted malt, Magic Cask, which combines Scotch single malts with a small touch of Canadian whiskey. I tried it at Whiskey Live Toronto, and I'm still kicking myself for not buying a bottle on the spot. By the way, you'll also start seeing new packaging for Compass Box whiskeys, starting with Oak Cross. Earlier this year, we talked about the changes at the Scotch Whiskey Heritage Center in Edinburgh, and now there's been another change. It's been renamed the Scotch Whiskey Experience, partly to attract more tourists who may not have realized that the center was a tourist attraction. Plans for reworking the center's tours are expected to be completed in early 2008. In the last episode, I promised more about Buffalo Trace Distillery's latest Distiller of the Year honor, this one from Wine Enthusiast magazine. Buffalo Trace Master Distiller Harlan Wheatley is just one of those celebrating.
You know, for us, you're reaching out to a whole kind of a different audience as well. You know, you're getting some of the wine drinkers and some of the wine people that you might not normally read Malt Advocate and the Whiskey magazine. So it's a whole other target audience for us.
Buffalo Trace has also won Distiller of the Year awards from Malt Advocate and Whiskey Magazine. And while I've talked a lot about Whiskey Fest in New York, there are other events that you might be interested in. This coming weekend is the FNB Whiskey Live Festival in Cape Town, South Africa, the Oslo Whiskey Festival in Norway, and the Hopscotch Festival in Vancouver. McAllen Ambassador Casper McRae will host tasting dinners at the Palm Restaurant in Dallas this Wednesday and at the Palm in Los Angeles on November 7th. And Isle of Jura's Willie Tate will host a tasting at the Brandy Library in New York City on Friday night. Again, there's a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. Jim Crile has been making whiskey for the last 40 years, and his love for the art of distilling hasn't wavered a bit. Earlier this year, he took the Glenlivet back to its early roots by cooking up a batch of whiskey in a small still, just like Glenlivet founder George Smith or the Scottish Moonshiners might have used two centuries ago. There wasn't a reason to, but why not? Sit back and relax. Jim, first of all, how did you get started in whiskey? Tell me the story, because I know you've been in it for most of your life. How did you get started in the whiskey business?
Well, I studied chemistry, and I worked for a couple of years with what we call the College of Agriculture, which is a government body that provides an advisory service to farmers on all different aspects of agriculture. And while I was doing that, I did some work on malting barley. And I knew nothing about whiskey really prior to that, but it kindled my interest. And there was a job advertised in the paper for someone with the kind of qualifications I had to join a whiskey company. And I applied for the job, and that was 40 years ago.
So your family had no background in whiskey. You didn't come by this by heredity like some other guys here did?
No, not at all. No. I was the first guy. My father really wasn't much of a drinker at all. My grandfather, I think I must have had some of his genes, because he liked a good dram. He enjoyed a good few whiskies in his time. But no, I had no connection with the whiskey industry. It was purely by accident that I eventually got involved in the business. And it's been wonderful. I've had a great time.
Give me the basic CV. How did you go through the business from 40 years ago?
Well, I joined what was then Highland Distillers as a sort of a trainee manager. And one of the things that I had to do was to establish a quality control laboratory for them. And that was really where the chemistry side of things came in. And while I was doing that, I learned about the malting process, because the distillery I was at that time was called Tamdu. And it had what they called a Saladin malting plant, which was how would you describe it? A semi-automated type of plant. So I learned about the malting there. Then I went, and also, of course, about distilling. And then I went to Islay, the Bonahaven Distillery. Spent 3 years over there. And then I went to a little distillery, which sadly is now closed, called Glenglassa. And it's on the Banffshire coast. It's between two little fishing villages called Cullen and Portsoy, and that was the first distillery I was there as manager. From there, I went back to Tamdu, and then I took a strange sidestep, and I was asked to get into sales and marketing. Sales was okay, marketing I didn't enjoy. So I wanted to get back into production. So that was when I came to Glenlivet as manager in 91. And so I was manager there for 15 years.
And you're basically now semi-retired?
Semi-retired now. They just take me off the shelf, dust me down, and say, off you go to Chicago gym, or off you go to Toronto gym and do something there, yeah.
Are you having...
It's great for me. I mean, I love it. It's...
Are you having fun?
Absolutely having fun. And I think that's what the... Well, generally, the wine and spirits industry is all about pleasure and enjoying yourself and, you know, drinking responsibly and so on. But it's a great trade to be in. And one of the great things about Scotch whisky is there's a relatively small number of people that run the industry. There's a relatively small number of people who are distillers and managers and all that kind of thing. And we all know each other, and we're all very friendly. And it comes as a big surprise to marketing people in different places around the world that we're so friendly. There's no competition back in Scotland. It's when you come here and you've got brands, that's when you've got competition. I could go, if I had a problem with Glenlivet with a particular piece of plant, a motor burned out or something, I didn't have a replacement, I could go to Highland Distillers, go to Diageo, go to whoever, and say, can you help me out here? Yeah, here you go. Take that one. When you get your replacement, give it back to me. And that's the way the industry is.
And it's always been that way, right?
It's always been that way, yeah. I mean, in terms of production, there's no competition. There is a fierce sense of pride in your own particular distillery, of course. But it's, you know, it's all very friendly.
How has it changed over the years, both for the better and for the worse?
Well, obviously, computer control, automation is far greater today than it was, say, 20 years ago. What I would say about that is that it probably makes the product more consistent because you're not relying on the human element and somebody on night shift having had a couple of drams too many and lets the still run too long. Whereas the machine, it's programmed to start collecting the middle cut at a certain time and stop collecting it at a certain time. So, you know, it's going to be more consistent. But we've lost a lot of the characters from the industry. We've lost a lot of the personal touch, you know. That with all the health and safety rules and regulations that you have today, there's no room for people to have eccentric characters and behaviors and so on, which could be really good fun.
And you've had a lot of that fun over the years, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure. I'm going to write a book one day, and I'm going to tell all those stories because there's lots of books, and they're all just about tasting notes, you know. Here's brand X, and it tastes this way, and brand Y, and it tastes another way. I want to write a little book that's sort of novel-based and just think about my time in the industry and just tell lots of little stories and intertwine into that tasting notes from different distilleries.
Tell me about your...
Whether I can do it or not, that's a different story.
Tell me about your first day in the distillery 40 years ago. What was it like?
Well, oh, gosh. Well, I started off, actually, originally in... there was a laboratory in Glasgow, and I started off down there. And then the first time I went to the distillery and went to Tamdu was into the malting plant, and it just... I'd obviously read books before I went for the interview to make sure that I knew what I was talking about, but it was just so different, there was just a sense of the people who were there. It was like a big family, and they didn't regard me as some young whippersnapper in here to run things. You know, they welcomed me and told me all about what was happening around the place. And not so much for myself, but for my wife, although we were only engaged at the time, and I took her up to show her where we were going to live when we got married, and she thought, where the hell are you taking me? Away into the hills.
And then off to Isla.
A couple of years later, off to Isla. Yeah, sure. Isla was good. I enjoyed Isla. I never acquired a taste for Isla whiskies. I can enjoy one, but I'm not a big fan of peaty whiskies. But it was all part of my experience and learning about the industry and seeing the way different whiskies were created.
That brings up an interesting point when you say you don't like peated whiskies. How have you, over the last few years, changed or tweaked the character of the Glenlivet, or have you, to make it the style of whiskey that you like?
I haven't tweaked it in any way at all. Basically, it should be still pretty much the same as it was, 170 years ago when the distillery first started, because it's on the same site, it's the same shape and size as stills. We've got old photographs and records and things that show us what they were doing in those days. So it goes back to what you said about technology and how things have changed. I think it's probably more consistent today than it was. I mean, I always felt that part of my job was to ensure that the newly distilled whiskey tasted the same each day, each week, each year. And modern technology has helped you to ensure that consistency.
But does it take something out of the overall fun to come up with something different every once in a while?
Yeah, well, the fun in coming up with something different is in the maturation and selecting different casks. So, the 15-year-old French oak, which was originally, we did it as a 12-year-old, and then we moved it to 15. That's where the fun comes in. For me, the fun is in going into the warehouse and sampling different casks, different ages. They've been filled once, twice, three times, whatever. That's the fun part, because you're never quite sure what you're going to get.
Paint that picture for me when you're walking into the distillery warehouse in the morning. What's it like?
The first thing that hits you is the aroma. I mean, all the old style warehouses have got very thick stone walls, so it's nice and cool, a little bit humid, and what hits you is that peppery alcohol aroma when you walk in. And I don't know quite just how to describe that, but I mean, if you do it, it's just one of those things that hits you. And then to go along and pull the bung in a cask and take a sample of that and put it in a glass and nose it, magic, absolutely magic.
Does a distiller have to like the style of whiskey he's producing? As I mentioned, we go back before, you said you're not a big fan of peated whiskeys.
Yeah.
But if you had to produce a peated whiskey, could you? Or do you have to like that style of whiskey in order to produce it?
Yeah. No, you don't personally have to like it, but you could ensure that you're producing the very best possible of that particular style. So as a distiller, I understand everything that goes into making a whiskey, and therefore I could produce for you any particular style of whiskey you wanted, given the shape and size of the stills and the water that you're using, because they have their own influence. So really, with one of the things about peated whiskies is, if you take peaty whiskies from the Speyside area, for example, they are very dry and smoky in character, because what you're getting is the smoke from the peat fire as you're drying the malted barley. You go to Isla, you're getting an entirely different flavor there, because there's a lot of peat in the water. So up on Speyside, the water is filtering through rocks. Over in Isla, the water is filtering through peat. So you're picking up a lot of peat character from the water. So, you can produce a peaty, smoky whiskey up in Speyside, but it's going to be totally different from a West Coast whiskey, because the water is so much different.
How much importance to you does wood play?
Oh, tremendously important. You are developing 50, 60, 70% of the final flavor in the wood. So, yeah, the cask is incredibly important. And again, that's something that a lot of people don't realize, no reason why they should. Wood is vitally important. You can change the flavor of a mature whiskey from different casks. And you know, no two casks are going to be exactly the same.
How long did it take you to come to that realization?
Oh, gosh, I suppose it's just all part of, you know, learning what the business is all about. And in the early days, just sampling the new whiskey and then going to warehouse and sampling some of the whiskeys at different ages. And you just build up that knowledge over the years. The first very obvious thing is the difference between a sherry cask and a bourbon cask. I mean, they're miles apart. So you learn that very quickly. And then over time, you learn the difference between second fill, third fill casks, and so on. And then, like with Glenlivet, with the French oak, we did experiments of putting whiskey into casks that the oak came from different areas. And you could, over time, we're sampling these and looking at them and just to see what the influence of the oak is. Hugely important. Never, ever underestimate the importance of the wood that you mature the whiskey in.
Last question. Let's say a few years down the road, you're coming down towards that one last dram. The one dram, the last dram you're ever going to get before the good Lord calls you home. You get your pick of anything you've made over the years, of all those whiskeys. What do you pick?
I don't think there's any contest, really. I mean, I would just go for our 18-year-old Glenlivet. That's my favorite. 21-year-old is exceptional, and it's a little bit special. But if I was just going to have one left, that's what I would go for, the 18-year-old.
I hope Jim writes his book soon. I'll stand in line for the first copy. Finally, I want to update the last episode and add a clarification. If you heard my interview with Barry Bernstein and Barry Steen of Premium Bottlers in Ontario, there's one key element that was left out. Canadian liquor laws require that bulk imports of liquor cannot be sold without at least some Canadian content added. And to meet that standard, Premium Bottlers vats its casks with 1% of Canadian malt whiskey. That's about 7.5 milliliters in a 750 milliliter bottle, but it also means that the whiskey has to be labeled a vatted malt whiskey. The error is mine, but on a brighter note, the Premium Bottlers whiskeys received rave reviews at this past week's Companions of the Quaich tasting in Toronto, and Companions president Ed Patrick told the Scotch blog he couldn't even taste a trace of the Canadian whiskey. That's all for this episode of Whiskey Cast. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2006, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.